You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Historical Society has received a grant to research sites in Milwaukee that have played a big role for African Americans in the city. We'll talk with a state preservation officer to learn more about that project.
First, thousands of anti-abortion demonstrators took to Washington, D.C. last Friday for the annual event they call the March for Life. This year is the 44th time the march has taken place. And it's one of the largest anti-abortion protests in the United States. This time around, it had at least one new ally, Vice President Mike Pence. It's the first time a sitting vice president has addressed the group in person. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
That's why this administration will work with the Congress to end taxpayer funding of abortion and abortion providers. And we will devote those resources to health care services for women across America.
Many from across the nation, including Wisconsin, made the trip to Washington to attend the rally. The statewide group Pro-Life Wisconsin sponsored buses to bring supporters out to the nation's capital and have their voices heard, including our next guest, who's here to talk about what happened at the event, as well as the future of the pro-life movement in Wisconsin and beyond.
Jade Hurdy is the communications director for Pro-Life Wisconsin. Jade, thanks for joining us.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Well, so first off, why was it important to you to attend this event in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, sure. That's usually the first question we get because it's kind of a rare thing to gather, right? A rally sometimes can be a rare thing. So it's important to get together with people who have the same views as us and show the nation that there, how many of us are there willing to take time off of work. It was a Friday and get together in D.C.
And how many of you were there, and especially how many from Wisconsin?
Sure. I don't have exact numbers of the total march, but our group, Pro-Life Wisconsin, brought 90 people to D.C.
And has this been your first march, or have you been before?
This was my first march, yes. So it was a new experience for me, and it was overwhelming at first because of the number of people, the number of signs, the street closures in Washington, D.C. It was overwhelming.
And while everyone, you know, may have their individual reasons for going, I'm sure there are common themes as well. What were some of those recurring themes that you heard from the Wisconsin contingent who went along on this trip?
Sure. A lot of people hear that being pro-life is not pro-women, and our group believes that being pro-life is pro-women, to empower women to embrace their fertility and show women that they can achieve their dreams without killing their unborn children. So a lot of people that came with us wanted to fight against that stereotype that isn't true about the pro-life movement. I heard that from a lot of people that came on my bus. And a lot of people are also hopeful with this new administration. VP Mike Pence spoke at the rally along with Kellyanne Conway, a presidential advisor. So it's great to have people who are in those offices of power in D.C. on our side.
What did Vice President Mike Pence have to say, and also Kellyanne Conway?
Well, unfortunately, the number of people it wasn't conducive to me to hear the speeches, but I have heard some of the comments afterwards, and Mike Pence has always been a strong pro-life advocate every time he's been elected. In fact, he put out the Pence Amendment several years ago, which defunded every single Planned Parenthood. Unfortunately, that wasn't approved in Congress. But I know Kellyanne Conway and Mike Pence, they're both on our side, as is the president.
You said you couldn't quite hear the speeches. It tells us it's a large event. But you talk about what kinds of things were happening there, maybe about some of the conversations you had with your fellow marchers.
Sure. Everyone is so friendly. We just would go up to other groups. Oh, I like your sign. Where are you from? Is this your first march? And you can just hear a bunch of stories about why people are pro-life. People, women who have children out of wedlock and were pressured to abort and maybe did, or they stood up to that pressure and didn't abort and they are glad that they didn't abort. So it's great to get together with those people and hear all those different stories, because you're right that there isn't one singular reason to be pro-life. There's so many backstories to everyone in this movement. And it's great to hear those stories and remember that we're a very diverse group all standing up for unborn children.
When you say a diverse group, can you describe some of the different people who might be in that coalition?
Sure, excuse me. Yes. So there's, of course, men and women of all ages. Many of the people that we brought from Wisconsin are in high school and in college. But we also had a grandma who brought her granddaughter, who's 17. So the age spectrum is from high school up to grandparent age, which, and then, of course, men and women of all different ages and every different ethnicity. It's not just a middle-class white person issue. It affects all races and everyone in the economic spectrum.
Jade Hurdy is with us right now. She's Communications Director for Pro-Life Wisconsin, and she's with us to talk about her experiences at last Friday's anti-abortion rally in Washington and the Wisconsin contingent who made that trip. And Jade, the executive director of the National Abortion Rights Action League, Pro-Choice Wisconsin, was critical of those who participated in that event. In an interview on Fox 11 News, she said, while the people marching might believe that they're fighting for the woman's best interest, what they're really arguing for is to restrict the rights given to her by the United States Constitution, and that is not okay. How would you respond to that critique?
Well, I first would ask, I mean, what is the most fundamental right? And that the answer, of course, is the right to life. So we restrict the choice of everyone to take someone else's life unless that person is unborn. So right now, you're right, it is legal for a mother to kill her unborn child, and we're fighting to reinstate the right to life for everyone, regardless of their age.
Recent data from the Guttmacher Institute, we talked about this last week on the show, actually, it shows that abortions in the United States are at the lowest level since Roe versus Wade. Why do you think that is?
Oh, definitely. I love to get this question. So it's because of technology showing the humanity of the womb. Every time a new ultrasound machine is developed, we can show a younger child, a less developed child inside the womb. And there's also more education. Anyone can find out about child development within the womb online. It's just available there 24/7. You don't have to go to a nurse in a hospital. You don't have to go to your mom if you're uncomfortable with that. You don't have to go to your parents. You can go online and find out if you're pregnant, you can find out how far along you are, what the baby looks like. All of those things are so readily available. And we're just going to continue to educate more young women about the life in the womb. And those numbers are going to continue to decline.
You said earlier that you're hopeful with the new administration that you will see some of the aims of your group advanced. Specifically, what are you hoping for? What are the goals?
Sure. The first one is the defunding of Planned Parenthood. Right now, they receive millions of tax dollars to fund their health clinics that aren't really helping women. Just a new study came out from Live Action that those clinics aren't actually offering prenatal care. All they're doing is abortion and giving out birth control. And that's not helping the women that they say they want to help. In Wisconsin, there's 7 clinics that are federally funded to every 1 Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood has 21 facilities in Wisconsin, and there's hundreds of other places women can go where they won't be offered the opportunity to kill their child.
Jade, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Jade Hurdy is the Communications Director for Pro-Life Wisconsin, and she was with us to talk about last Friday's anti-abortion rally in Washington. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up later, we'll talk to a legal scholar who says the United States Supreme Court may serve the American people better by only having 8 justices on the bench. We'll find out why.
First, the Wisconsin Historical Society has received a grant from the Department of the Interior to research sites in Milwaukee that have been significant to the African American community.
The state's Historic Preservation Office plans to nominate 4 properties to be included in the National Register of Historic Places. It's part of a nationwide effort to share the stories of groups that have been underrepresented in American history.
We're joined in the studio now by Jim Drager. He's the State Historic Preservation Officer for the Wisconsin Historical Society. And he's also the co-author of books about Wisconsin's historic taverns and gas stations. Jim, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, the grant that the State Historical Society has gotten is part of a nationwide project from the Department of the Interior to find places that tell the story of underrepresented communities. How is this effort going to accomplish that?
Okay. Well, first of all, the National Register of Historic Places is an attempt to recognize properties that tell the broad stories of the country, the kind of sweeping stories that help define who Americans are and, by extension, who people in Wisconsin are. And frankly, over the years, it's done a pretty lousy job of telling the stories of people who are more often disenfranchised. You know, it started out telling the story of rich white men. And as years have gone on, we've understood that history is much more rich than that and much more deep than that. And so it's part of an effort to recognize that.
So here in Wisconsin, how is the money going to be used?
Well, we're going to focus in Milwaukee on the African-American community. Milwaukee's always had the largest number of African-Americans in the state. In the 1930s, about 70% of African-Americans lived in Milwaukee. So we thought that was a good place to start. And so we have been doing some pre-research for a few months before we applied for the grant, trying to determine what prospective properties might be out there.
And what'd you find?
Well, we found, as you might imagine, there are properties that are associated with the institutional life of the city, African-American fraternal halls, organizations like the NAACP and the NAACP's Youth Council, properties associated with people who are significant movers and shakers in the African-American community, and properties that just sort of reflect the social life of African-Americans.
And I read about one that's under consideration, a home that was also known by the alternate name of the Casablanca Hotel.
Sure.
So yeah. Interesting. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. In the days of segregation, African Americans, when they traveled, were often discriminated against in terms of restaurants and lodging spaces. And they even published separate guides called Green Guides for traveling African Americans, so they knew where it was safe to go and where it was safe to eat. One of those places was a home in Milwaukee that was used sort of as a boarding home. And when famous African-American musicians came to Milwaukee to perform, people like Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong, they stayed in these people's home.
And the home, there's a picture of it in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The home is beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I looked at the home and I thought, this is going to be the home of wealthy couple, and it mm-hmm. sounds like they were maybe more working class. Not yeah. much known about this couple. What do we know?
Well, we don't know all that much about them yet. You know, that's the purpose of the grant, is to allow us to dig deeper. But that's right. They were just working class people and happened to live in a big home, and they made money by renting, portions of the home out as a sort of a lodging house.
So how do you find the stories behind it? Once you've identified these places yeah. of interest, how do you go digging when there may not be that much of record?
Well, that's a real challenge when you look at some of these groups, because they're not well represented in written histories. And you have to go to primary sources. Milwaukee had black newspapers, so we'll be combing through the newspapers to see what they said about them. We'll be looking at city directories. We'll be talking to people in the community and doing oral histories with people. One of the really interesting things about getting this grant is the grandson of that family called me on the phone shortly after it hit the Milwaukee newspapers and started telling me stories about the hotel.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, give me your name and number and we'll be back to you as soon as we get the money.
A lot of stories there, I bet. Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of them. Another you're looking at is the first African-American owned bank.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you know about that one?
Well, it was established in 1971, and It's very interesting. In the 1930s, in the entire United States, there were only something like a little over 25 African-American banks, and there were none in Milwaukee. And as the white flight happened in Milwaukee in the 70s and 80s, banking institutions moved out too. And, you know, today we talk about food deserts in urban places in poorer neighborhoods. Well, there were banking deserts where there just weren't financial institutions that were there to serve the African-American community. So some business people got together and decided to open the first African-American bank and struggled quite a bit in the very beginning trying to get everything organized and to open the bank, but ultimately opened it in 1971.
These stories sound interesting. I mean, I'm thinking about especially the family connection of that home, the Casablanca Hotel. How do you identify some of these places that history has left by the wayside to begin with?
Well, usually there are some traces here and there, you know. So the newspapers occasionally talked about things like that. Sometimes there's the kind of oral history of the community. People know about places or about people. Some of it makes its way into the written historical record, you know, like the work of the NAACP in Milwaukee is pretty well documented. We have records from that organization that we can look to, that sort of thing. So it's just being a good historical detective and following the leads and trying to think of the most likely sources that you can find information in.
Jim Drager is with us right now from the Wisconsin Historical Society talking about plans to nominate four properties to be included in the National Register of Historic Places. And this is part of a national effort. This is not just Wisconsin. Why do you think it's important to tell these stories, to have this available and part of the acknowledged shared history of a community?
Well, I think you right on the mark right there. It's a shared history. And all communities help to build Wisconsin culture. And that needs to be recognized. If we're talking about preserving the things that are meaningful, that tell us how we got to where we are and why things are the way they are, they need to include the stories of all people.
So what happens once you identify these places? You've got some contenders. You've told us about a couple of them. How do you narrow that down?
Well, we will look at we will examine all of those buildings. The National Register of Historic Places requires that properties retain what they call historic integrity, which means that they physically represent that period of time where they are important. So we'll be looking at them and trying to determine how original are they, what has changed, if what's changed has been important or not. We'll be looking at the stories and try to tease out how those stories meet the criteria for listing in the National Register and make that case of what the important contribution was to the broad patterns of history or why this person was a significant person in the history of Milwaukee. That sort of analysis has to happen.
And that happens, and then four get chosen. What does it mean? How big a deal is this for one of these locations to be on this National Register?
Well, you know, it's mostly an honor. Properties that are listed on the National Register are recognized as being properties that are important in our history. But it also brings some potential financial benefits that can help to preserve these properties over time. And it probably more than anything else, it brings community recognition. You sort of get that property on the map, the cultural map of how people see the city of Milwaukee and what its stories are.
So speaking of acknowledgement in the community, how does the community get to interact with these properties and find out more?
Well, in the process of the project, we'll be having some meetings in Milwaukee and sharing the results of our research and getting input from people. The National Register is a public, the nominations are public documents, and anyone can view them. We put them up on our website. We write stories that promote those listings. So there will be a lot of different ways where people can interact with those properties.
So for you, how exciting is this opportunity to get to know the community better, to hear these stories that maybe no one but a few select people may know still?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. That's a really great part of the job is rediscovering history in Wisconsin that may have been forgotten or poorly remembered, and being able to really celebrate that these properties are part of what makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin.
And for the public, again, is there any chance that any of these would be open as a historic site where you could go in and tour, say, the Casablanca Hotel?
I think that's going to be a matter of the owners. You know, one of the balances that you make when you recognize these properties is making sure that people understand that many of these properties are private properties and they're not publicly open for tours, and that you need to respect the rights of the people who own them. But that doesn't mean that they may not be so excited about the histories that they decide on their own that they want to open them up.
Are there any that we should know more about already that we could visit African-American landmarks in the city of Milwaukee, or maybe others of other communities that you think maybe haven't gotten the attention they deserve, but are neat landmarks to go visit?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there are lots of groups that whose properties have not been recognized. One of the real challenges when you're dealing with trying to recognize the history of people who have been the subject of persecution and segregation is that many of those properties get torn down. You know, some of the most important African-American properties in Milwaukee were torn down during the urban renewal process. You know, as preservationists, we call it urban removal because that's what it did really well. And in the African-American communities in Milwaukee, they just demolished scores of properties. But it's an effort that we're going to continue. When the grant ends, we are going to continue to be working on recognizing properties like that. So I just say stay tuned and keep watching, and we'll be turning up more.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to hearing more about your research.
Thank you.
That was Jim Draeger, the State Historic Preservation Officer for the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear the case for a permanent 8-justice bench for the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's investigative reporting on Reveal. Tonight, Reveal heads to Jacksonville, Florida, one of the most divided cities in America, for a look at policing, immigration, education, and other issues through the eyes of people with very different perspectives. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, since the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia almost a year ago, there have been only 8 justices on the bench of the nation's highest court. Former President Barack Obama had previously nominated Judge Merrick Garland to fill the seat, though no action was taken to confirm him. And President Trump says he'll announce his pick to fill that seat tomorrow evening.
But what if the court stayed at 8 justices for good? It's an idea supported by our next guest, who wants to shake up how the court does business. He says Congress should permanently set the number of justices at 8 and keep a balance between Republican and Democratic appointees.
Eric Siegel joins us now. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University's College of Law, and he recently published a paper titled 8 Justices Are Enough, a Proposal to Improve the United States Supreme Court. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me tonight. Good evening.
Well, before we get into the practicalities of this 8-justice court, you're saying this would improve the Supreme Court. So what's wrong with the way the Supreme Court currently works?
Well, that could take a much longer show than we have. But I think there are many issues with our justices, and many of them are tied to life tenure. We have the only high court in the world, whose justices serve for life. And, you know, when you are given a lot of governmental power, which they have, and it's more or less unreviewable, which it is, and you're told you can have your job for life, you're going to end up seeing the vague value judgments in the law the way you want to see them. The Constitution is extraordinarily difficult to apply and interpret, and personal values are going to seep in the best of circumstances. But given life tenure and how our tradition of judicial review has evolved, the justices end up doing pretty much what they want. So we've had periods in American history where an ideologically aligned majority of justices has imposed their will on Americans in some pretty ugly ways. Just quick examples. From 1900 to 1935, the court struck down over 200 state and federal laws involving unions and worker safety and minimum wages, all of which would be legal today because five or more justices could. On the other hand, some people think the Warren Court went way too far in its protection of fundamental rights and that kind of thing. And a lot of people think the Roberts Court has gone much too far in choking off avenues for redress for people who are injured. So the problem is what we really have in this country is a unique political institution made up of really political officials we call judges, but who really act more like politicians. And that's a real problem. Those are the problems as I see them.
And we've talked to a guest before with a group that wants some kind of term limits from the U.S. Supreme Court, but that's a really tall order.
Right. The problem with that is that would take a constitutional amendment. So I'm in favor of that. But that really can't happen. And, you know, once you open up the constitutional amendment process, things get very dicey. My proposal not only does not require a constitutional amendment, but my proposal is also in the interest of both political parties. And in 2017 America, there were virtually no proposals that are in the interest of both political parties. But mine happens to be. And I want to say also that although I self-identify as, you know, kind of a progressive, not kind of a progressive, I made this proposal long before anybody thought Trump would win. I mean, I thought this was the right thing to do back in May and June and July of last year, and then even after Hillary. You know, this is a nonpartisan proposal that would improve one of the three branches of government significantly, and it happens to be in the long-term interests of both Republicans and Democrats. Having said all that, obviously it's not going to happen anytime soon, although you never know. So what's going to happen in the next few weeks is the president's going to nominate somebody, and the Democrats are going to filibuster, almost certainly, and the Republicans will probably end the filibuster. But they may not be able to. You know, if three or four Republicans switch, this could be a long, 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 drawn-out process. If that happens, you never know. You never know.
Talking to Eric Siegel from the Georgia State University College of Law, he says eight is enough when it comes to U.S. Supreme Court justices. He wants to see a change in procedure here. Instead of nine, with an ideological balance maybe shifting all the time, keep eight, keep four appointed by each side of the aisle. So, Eric, we're seeing this in action now for generally considered liberal justices, for generally conservative justices. And a lot of people are saying, oh, the Supreme Court's shorthanded, bad, not working, ties, not resolving anything. You see this as a good thing. Why?
Yes, no, it's been great. So, first of all, the sky hasn't fallen, no matter what anybody, clearly the sky has not fallen, and it's been over a year. What an eight-person, evenly divided court has to do, and let me say my proposal doesn't work unless it's four Republicans and four Democrats, but we have a model for that in the Federal Election Commission, which by law has to be even number. So we could do this. With an even number of Republicans and Democrats on the court, then the justices have to have more narrow decisions, more bipartisan decision-making in the cases that divide the court. Now, I should say 80% of Supreme Court cases are not decided 5-4 when there's a nine-person court, and almost half are unanimous. So the federal Supreme Court's ability to maintain the uniformity and supremacy of federal law wouldn't go away in 80% of the cases. In the 20% of the cases, historically, where they've been 5-4, which would now be 4-4, and probably a tie, the justices would have to do something because they wouldn't want to lose their power over time. No governmental official, no matter how well-intentioned, wants to lose their power over time. So what they would do is make narrower decisions, more incremental decision-making, and I think that would be a good thing, and that's how judges are supposed to act. The other thing is, if the court does tie 4-4, and if it's four Republicans and four Democrats, which it almost always would be, then the case doesn't go away in the sense that nothing happens. The lower court decision would be the law of the land. There are 12 courts of appeals, and those are hundreds of judges who are much more diverse politically, educationally, and geographically than the nine lawyers who sit in Washington their whole lives. And the reason that's important is, in almost every constitutional law case that comes before the court, the question is, should the justices replace a rule made by other people, the Congress, the states, the people, with their own views? That's the question. Are the justices going to replace a rule decided by other people with their own rule. And they shouldn't do that unless they're pretty sure. And my proposal then requires at least one Republican to vote with the Democrats or one Democrat to vote with the Republicans. At the turn of the century, there was a big at the turn of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, there was a big debate about whether the court should even ever displace a state or federal law on a 5-4 vote. That maybe there should be more clarity than that. And I agree with that. And that's why I say it's in the long-term interests of both political parties and, for that matter, the American people for this proposal. Because the court wouldn't strike down laws unless there was some bipartisan buy-in. And I think that's important.
But here's where it gets weird, because you mentioned those appeals courts. Maybe one appeals court over here rules yes. The one over there rules no. The Supreme Court, they're deadlocked. And so now we've got a different set of federal laws or a different view on federal laws applying in those five states versus these four states.
Now, so that's the most common objection to this plan. And here's the response. Right now, 99.999% of all state and federal cases never get to the Supreme Court, ever. So in those 99.99% of cases, the objection you just made doesn't apply, obviously, because the Supreme Court never hears the case. In the 75 cases a year the court takes, as I mentioned earlier, only 20% are 5-4. So of those 15 cases, the question is how many will raise the kind of uniformity issue you're concerned about? And the answer is virtually none. So here's the thing. I'm pro-choice. I would like the whole country to be pro-choice. I am, whatever my views are, I want the whole country to have them. But it's not because of uniformity. It's because I think my views are best. And the reality is we've had different rules about abortion, affirmative action, gun control in the states, you know, across the country for a very long time. It's almost never necessary for there to be a national rule for national rule's sake. But there are times. I concede with securities regulation, you know, disputes and other economic planning controversies, we need one rule. No one's more critical of the Supreme Court than I am, but let me say this. Everybody who serves and has served on the Supreme Court loves court and loves country. They do. They're patriots. They're hardworking civil servants. If the fate of the country requires one national rule, they will find a way to compromise and they will find a way to get it done. They will, because they're patriots. They do. They care about America. That case is very, very, very rare. I mean, really rare. So the uniformity objection really doesn't, to me, carry a lot of weight, since we almost never care about it anyway, because as I said at the beginning of this monologue, 99.9% of cases in America never get to the Supreme Court.
We're talking to law professor Eric Siegel. He's proposing a reform for the United States Supreme Court. He's saying, forget nine, we should have 8 justices serving, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans. He says that would force the court to work harder to reach narrower decisions in its most difficult cases and be less able, if there's an ideological majority, for them to impose their agendas on the American people.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of a Supreme Court with only 8 justices? Do you think it would better serve the public, or would it create more problems? And whether it's this idea or something else, do you think the Supreme Court is in need of some kind of reform? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Eric Siegel, professor of law at Georgia State University. He recently published a paper called 8 Justices Are Enough, a proposal to improve the United States Supreme Court.
The plan, 8 justices, 4 appointed by Democrats, 4 Republicans, liberal, conservative, even split. He says things will be better. Things will work better. No ideological majority imposing decisions on the public. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Would 8 justices instead of 9 better serve the public if they're evenly split? Do you think that would generate compromise or confusion? Does the Supreme Court need to be tinkered with in the first place? Do you see problems, or are you happy with the way it works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Seth is on the line in Mequon. Seth, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
So I actually was not into the idea until he explained it further. Now I'm sort of on board. But my question is, personally, I'm libertarian, and I was wondering how would this work if a third party such as the Libertarian Party were to break into politics in
America? That's a great question, Seth. Seth, that's a great question, and I do address that in the paper. So first of all, I think that's reasonable. Like, what about independence? My proposal includes a subsection, if you were, that says that, if a person identifies as an independent or refuses to identify their political party affiliation, then they can still get in the Supreme Court, but it would take a two-thirds, as opposed to a majority, vote of the Senate. It would take a two-thirds vote, and they would count as the political party of the nominating president. So I do have an out for that. But let me tell you why that objection, while reasonable, I don't think torpedoes the proposal at all. There are no independent Supreme Court justices. I mean, virtually every Supreme Court justice of the last 50 years, we have known their political party affiliation, because guess what? To be nominated to the Supreme Court, you pretty much have to have an identifiable political party affiliation. Having said that, I am sensitive to the charge that this proposal does ensconce the two-party system even more. But you know what? Given the unfortunate state of affairs in America, where we have this strong two-party system, I think the dramatic improvement to the court, and by the way, we haven't talked about the confirmation process, which would be improved tremendously by this proposal, that outweighs the objection you're making, which is a very reasonable objection. Can I talk about the confirmation process for 1 minute?
Yeah, go for it.
What right now, the political nature of our Supreme Court is determined by death, serious illness, or politically timed retirements. That is insane. So, for example, Justice Ginsburg, who's an American hero, and, you know, you're not going to find more important people in this country's history than Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We, you know, liberals are rooting for her to last four more years, and no matter how sick she gets. Like, if you asked a really well-meaning liberal, what if she gets really, really sick and can't do the job, they would say, she should stay on the job. That makes no sense at all. And another example of that is Justice Thurgood Marshall, another American hero, who thought Bill Clinton was going to lose to the first President Bush, so he retired because he was very sick, and then Clarence Thomas got on the court. If Marshall had thought Clinton was going to win, which he didn't, and if he had hung on another year, there would have been no Clarence Thomas. Without Clarence Thomas, there's no Citizens United. There's no Heller gun decision. There's no Shelby County voter ID decision. To make our country's, you know, social, economic, legal policy determined by death, sickness, or politically timed retirements is crazy. Under my proposal, if a Democratic justice wants to resign, she'll know she'll be replaced by a Democratic justice, or vice versa.
Seth, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the only time anybody seems to have a job until they die is if they own their own company, and I think this is ridiculous. And to bring new ideas and new blood, I think this would be a great way to churn this out and have a more fair system. And how do you move this forward?
Well, so if there was the political will to do so, it would be easy. The Constitution doesn't have a number of justices. That is up to Congress. By the way, the original number was six. For those originalists out there, I'm not one, but for those originalists, the original number was six. Then it went to nine. In 1869, Congress passed a law saying nine. Congress could pass a law tomorrow saying eight. So that's the first step. That's easy. That's fully constitutional. The second step would be passing another law saying that there have to be four Republicans and four Democrats on the court, or pick any even number and divide it by two. They've already done that with the Federal Election Commission, so they know how to do that. Now, the president could nominate anybody he or she wants. In other words, I can't stop. It would be unconstitutional to limit the president's nominating power. But the Senate doesn't have to approve anybody, as we learned over the last year. So the Senate could say, you can send us whoever you want to send us, but we're not going to approve them unless they are of the same political party as the justice who retired or died. So it wouldn't be hard if the political will was there. Now, one more thing about that. When I talk about this proposal publicly, people say the Federal Election Commission is terrible. Nothing gets done. They're always deadlocked. And that's true. It's been a disaster. But the reason for that is because there's only one, and if an important issue, is before the commission and they're deadlocked, nothing gets done. If the Supreme Court deadlocks, that's not true. The lower court decision will be the law, And that does a lot of good. So it's not the same, in other words, it's not the same roadblock. So I think we have a model for this, how to do it. All we need is the political will.
Cindy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Eric Siegel from the Georgia State University Law School. He says, forget 9 justices, switch it to 8. Congress can do it. Make it 4 appointed by, backed by each party. Things will work better, he says. But here's the thing, as far as actually making it happen, if I'm the party with the president, I don't want to relinquish the power, especially if the president and the same party have a majority in the Senate, as is the case now. Who's going to give up the shot to appoint 1 or 2 or 3 justices, swing things in their favor?
That's a great question. I have 2 responses. The first is the filibuster, which requires 60 votes to end debate in the Senate, which is about to go away. And the Democrats took it away for lower court judges a couple years ago. The filibuster has worked the way it was supposed to work, if you believe in it, since the mid-18th century. Why would a majority party in the Senate agree to lose its power to the minority? The answer to that is because someday they'll be the minority. And really, think about the filibuster. It has absolutely played a major role in American history since the 19th century. In the early 1960s, civil rights legislation completely blocked the Senate from doing anything. The majority party had majority votes, but they went along with it because they knew someday they'd be the minority. That's the first answer. The second answer is, if I was talking to Ted Cruz today, if I was talking to Senator Mike Lee today, if I was talking to any senator on the Senate Judiciary Committee or in the Senate, I would say, in the long run, this reduces the ability of the Supreme Court to overturn your laws, whether you're in the majority, whatever. It does. It diminishes that ability. That's in your long-term interest. In addition, I would say, Senator Cruz, you're the one who's always yelling about states' rights. You're the one who thinks the court shouldn't, you know, interfere unless it's hopelessly unconstitutional. This furthers that goal. The court will be less able to strike down state laws because it'll take some bipartisan effort to do so. So forget tomorrow or next week. In the long run, this proposal helps you, Mr. Senator, no matter which party you're in. So that would be my argument.
So I want to touch on current events a bit here. President Trump expected to announce his nominee tomorrow evening to replace Antonin Scalia on the bench. What are you watching for? What are you expecting from the nomination and the confirmation?
Well, about two months ago, I wrote that normally presidents appoint justices that will help them with the issues they care the most about. Now, that's not always true. For example, Ronald Reagan promised a female Supreme Court justice and then appointed Justice O'Connor, and you know, good for him for doing that. But most of the time, absent some identity politics, presidents appoint judges who will do what they want them to do. The thing Trump cares most about, besides money, from what I can tell, is he hates government regulation. He doesn't like, you know, he doesn't like environmental regulations. He doesn't like the federal government getting involved. Because of that, one of the people on his list, Gorsuch from Colorado, has been very public that he is willing to revisit the law of deference to administrative agencies, meaning he's more likely to strike agency regulations down. So that's my prediction. My prediction will be him, but apparently Trump's sister knows Judge Hardiman from the Third Circuit and likes him. So to the extent Trump's sister, who's a federal judge, by the way, to the extent Trump listens to his sister, who knows? And then again, who knows what he's going to do? By the way, from Judge Sykes from the Seventh Circuit, from your neck of the woods, mm-hmm. I just heard, was also interviewed. So I think she's, you know, I think she's probably high on the list as well.
And we'll have to leave it there. Eric, thanks for joining us. That was Eric Siegel, professor of law at Georgia State University's College of Law. We've been talking about his recently published paper, 8 Justices Are Enough, a Proposal to Improve the United States Supreme Court.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.